You can't replace part of the brain. Like, you
treat them the same.
The source of truth for the medtech industry.
Coexists with the
robot. Robot understands things automatically.
Number one show in the medtech industry.
So Stryker got ahead of that and changed it. In the 90s, built a $1 billion company. It helped up high. A lot of things.
State of medtech.
With your host, Omar M. Khatib.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show, and we're continuing our Autism Acceptance Month series, this time with another clinician slash entrepreneur, and that's Dr. Sharif Tahraman, somebody who I've become a big fan of, mainly because how vocal he is about the current state of autism, and more importantly, things that should not be the way they are. He wrote a great piece on LinkedIn recently about things that he does not accept. I highly recommend you go check that out. But let me give a little bit of background on him. Dr. Tahraman is a dual board certified in neurology with special qualifications in child neurology from the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology and Clinical Informatics from the American Board of Perioperative Medicine. He was the former division chief of pediatric neurology at Children's Health of Orange County and University of California, Irvine. He remains an active member of the medical staff and the Sharon Disney Lund Medical Intelligence Information Investigation and Innovation Institute at CHOC. And currently, he is the CEO of Cognoa. Cognoa is this really fantastic company. They essentially innovate solutions for child developmental health. They have a breakthrough product called Canvas DX. It's the first and only FDA-authorized autism diagnostic for children ages 1.5 to 6 years old that uses responsible AI, to empower doctors to quickly and accurately and fairly diagnose developmental risk without bias. Their digital solutions are child-centric and designed to find, assess, and treat developmental concerns early within the time windows that yield the optimal outcomes. They have a very proprietary whole child approach, which we talk about in the show, where essentially their approach to AI fuels their pipeline of diagnostic and therapeutic products for autism, speech and language, ADHD, child anxiety, and more. For more information, go check out cognoa.com. That's cognoa.com. And if you're a clinician, they recently just received a Highmark approval. And so they are covered by that insurance. And the best part is that you can start using it without prior authorization, So go to cognoa.com to learn more. So in this episode, we talk about the current state of autism and so much more. And again, I've become such a big fan of clinicians like Dr. Tahraman, Dr. Chettipalli, who was on last week, where essentially they've just taken a very active role in driving awareness around autism, but more importantly, how we get better about getting these children the help that they need sooner and faster. So that being said, let's get on to our episode with Dr. Sharif Tahraman, CEO of Cognoa. Enjoy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Another episode that's sort of highlighting Autism Acceptance Month. Last week, you had Dr. Yuli Chettipalli on. Fantastic guest. This week, we have another friend of mine, Dr. Sharif Tahraman, who is a child neurologist, but also a medtech entrepreneur. He's the CEO of Cognoa. Cognoa provides early, rapid, and equitable diagnosis for autism. They're a digital health company with their product called Canvas DX. Canvas DX is the first and only FDA-authorized diagnostic solution designed for clinicians to essentially rapidly diagnose and unlock next steps for autism. So, Sharif, thanks for coming on the show. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks, Dr. Omar. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it, man.
Great topic. Something that I'm really passionate about is helping children with neurodevelopmental disorders, and specifically kids with autism and families going through the diagnostic process and treatment.
Absolutely. And I got to give you some a compliment. I think it's so important these days, especially considering how much the average consumer uses social media, that thought leaders like you, clinicians specifically, are spending time on social media to post, content, educate, the public and everything. So that way they make better, more informed decisions. You recently had a great paper, an article last week that was published. You published it on the blog, but also on LinkedIn. I'll share in the show notes below about things you don't accept about autism. And can you kind of like go through that list, for us, and why is it that you don't accept these things?
Yeah, no, I think that this is a kind of a little bit of a controversial topic. And it's not so much about accepting autism as a diagnosis or as a neurodevelopmental or neurologic presentation. It's really about the dysfunction of our healthcare system and the dysfunctional way we try and maybe help people. And I think, you know, the biggest thing and actually a huge motivator for me to leave outpatient clinical medicine and join Cognoa, formerly as the chief medical officer, was I was seeing kids show up into my office, mostly minoritized individuals, so persons of color, kids of lower socioeconomic status, you know, kids of immigrant parents, and lots of females who did not benefit from an early diagnosis of autism. And for me, that was not only super frustrating, but also actually exceedingly motivating to say, somebody's got to do something about this. And we have to figure out a systematic, better approach to helping these individuals know what's going on. Because I think that's the other big thing is, you know, it used to be called Autism Awareness Month, and now, converted into Autism Acceptance Month. But the reality is that how can you accept something if you don't even understand it or know what it is? And I think as much as we can get to autism acceptance, you have to know first.
No, I completely agree. And I think that, cliche saying, but it's true that knowledge is power. You know, one of the sections you wrote about that I liked, that I really enjoyed, was the isolation versus collaboration. And I thought that was really important to call out. Can you kind of sort of dive into that a little bit more?
Yeah, this is a really kind of an interesting thing that happened just historically with, and I think that this is not only true of neurodevelopmental disorders, but actually a lot of the psychiatry type things that have been stigmatized. So what happened was, is the physician colleagues that I have, we sort of abdicated our responsibility for making neurodevelopmental evaluations over to psychologists. And I feel like on a medical side, a lot of the psychiatric conditions that exist, like obsessive compulsive disorder or anxiety, because of some of the stigmas related to it, we haven't really invested in understanding the neurobiology of it and then thinking about, okay, how do we influence or modify that neurobiology? And so what happened is that many individuals are now, unfortunately, getting isolated psychological assessments without that medical lens being connected to them. And I think that the biggest challenge that we have with that is that when you do that isolated evaluation, you're missing the whole medical side of the house. And so I can tell you that I've seen situations where, you know, kids who have maybe a partial seizure, where they may have some strange staring off and some, you know, stereotypic looking movements, are in fact actually having a seizure, but because someone's not trained in that medical capacity, that seizure gets missed. And we know that, for example, many individuals, up to 30% and vice versa, autism and epilepsy, epilepsy and autism, have this overlying presentation. So if you have autism, you have a high rate of epilepsy. If you have epilepsy, you have a high rate of autism. The other one that's actually really also kind of challenging that can be missed is, you know, kids with, you know, an underlying metabolic, maybe an immunological disorder that's presenting as autism. So autism, in some ways, is not a can be a manifestation of something else that's underlying that we better understand from an organic neurobiologic processes. And so, again, I think it's important that we shouldn't be doing these things in isolation. We really need a collaborative approach. And it really should start, in my opinion, in the medical home with the primary care physician that knows the family, that knows this child and has been following them since their birth and watching the development.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, something that I found very interesting when it came to Cogno, which you guys do, again, you guys were one of the few FDA, the only FDA approved technologies for this, is that I'm not a clinician, but correct me if I'm wrong, I think the average clinician can diagnose the more common and obvious cases for autism, but there's a lot of other cases where they're more borderline. The symptoms may be a lot more subtle, and those children don't get diagnosed early enough, and they sort of move on in life and don't get the help they need. Is that correct?
Yeah, so there's actually like two different sort of problems that are happening. So the first one is that you're right. There are cases which are, you can call them more obvious, and the clinician who's seeing them in the primary care setting is like, oh, I know this is autism. But the problem, and this is another thing I just can't accept, is we've created these unacceptable policies or allowed them to exist. So there are state mandates, which are kind of dysfunctional, and there are insurance company mandates that say, no, even if you're a physician, we don't accept your diagnosis of autism. We will not give this child services for autism-specific care because we don't recognize your diagnosis of autism. It must go to a specialist. You must do certain research-based tools that are repurposed for clinical care. And if the child doesn't have that assessment, then they won't be able to get services. So that's actually a really big problem and is a huge hindrance to getting kids that early intervention, which we know makes a huge difference. I think to your second point, and this is where artificial intelligence can be very helpful. So even as a very busy clinician in my lifetime, in my career, I may see, if I'm really working hard, maybe 50,000 cases of neurodevelopmental disorders present to my clinic and in my experience. We have learnings now on over 300,000 patients. Our last clinical trial set included 722 patients. I mean, to do that kind of, see that volume, no single clinician can do that. And so these more subtle presentations can be picked up by the artificial intelligence because it's looking at such a huge volume of children. And again, we were very intentional to make sure that we included a diverse sample of patients and we included females. And we actually went out and were intentional about making sure that we included people even from the indigenous population. So in our clinical trials, we had two sites on the they recruited from the Indian Health Services. And I think all of that's important because as much as people talk about potential biases in artificial intelligence and digital health, the reality is we've got longstanding racial, ethnic, you know, sex biases in our healthcare system. And that includes very well documented the status quo of evaluating neurodevelopmental delays. And some of that is, you know, healthcare driven by the providers or the clinicians, but a lot of it's actually from the tools that we're using because they were not normalized and not tested and not validated and not trained up on a diverse sample like we did with Canvas DX.
And that's really interesting to hear. And that's one of the things that I like about digital platforms and therapeutics is that it augments a clinician's expertise because, again, like it's really rare that as a clinician, you're going to be kind of like your own walking algorithm and see that many cases. And even in that event, you have to make sure that you're at the top of your game that day to notice like the subtle nuances that might be there that tip you off to sort of dig deeper and make that diagnosis, right? So there's like too much that's being weighted on luck versus what you're sort of advocating for is the augmentation through AI so that clinicians, there's like no way these things can get missed and they get diagnosed earlier, correct?
Absolutely. And the other thing that's actually really important is, you know, look, at the end of the day, I might have a bad day, right? The kid who's seeing me might have traveled really long distance and be hangry, right? They're tired and angry, and they're going to present differently. And so in a single assessment, trying to capture and understand what the child has can be challenging. And this is actually why many times kids are actually seen through many, many visits. On average, parental concern to time to diagnosis, 3 years, and lots and lots of visits with lots and lots of different clinicians. And the problem is that you've now wasted 3 years of critical neurodevelopmental window that you can't get back, right? The brain has this really neurodevelopmental critical window that, you know, starts around, you know, a year or two of age and starts closing around 4, 5, 6 years of age. And so if you're diagnosing kids at the age of 4, which is our national average, it's too late, right? And actually, as a country, we have, goals that we're trying to get these kids into early intervention before the age of 3, but we're failing as a country. So one of the beautiful things that we did with Canvas DX, and this is based on the work from Dr. Wall, our founder, Dennis, is he was looking at actually the power of naturalistic videos that the parents can provide of their children at home, which actually turned out to be much more representative and much more powerful and helping us as clinicians and helping the algorithm understand what is this child's actual development look like? Do they have repetitive and stereotypical movements? You know, what is their eye contact? What is their joint attention? How is this child's behavior and development actually look versus an artificial environment, which is our clinics, where the child may not and often actually does not present in a typical form. And many parents tell me this is different than what my child normally does at home, or you don't see what they're worried about because it didn't show up in the visit, right? Because you can't simulate the garbage truck coming down the street and that child's reaction to the garbage truck or whatever the thing is that tends to be the trigger for some atypical behavior that is of concern.
That makes a lot of sense. And I guess that was the thing I was trying to understand, which is the key to early diagnosis is that because of that neurodevelopmental period, that, you know, the earlier years are so critical, is to understand that if whatever neurological diagnosis your child has, that they get the correct, I don't want to call it treatment, but educational, like, support, correct?
But in a way, it's treatment, it's therapy, right? So, like, I'll give you an example, right? If I have...
Go ahead. I was going to say, I have a scenario. So, like, how early can someone be diagnosed for autism? Let's just say a clinician using Canvas DX.
So we're labeled down to 18 months of age. And the reason that 18 months of age was selected is because that's where most clinicians can reliably diagnose, based on literature, a stable diagnosis of autism.
Oh, yeah.
But the key thing is what you're trying to do is, so most parents, again, have a concern. Sometimes around 14, 15 months is the average, where they go, something's a little bit off. My child's not speaking like the other 15-month-old kids, right? Their movements look a little bit different. Something's amiss, right? And then what happens is by 18 months, you can start seeing just, and again, this has to do with the way the brain develops. So there's this concept called myelination. So for the listeners who are non-clinical, myelination is a special fat substance that kind of coats your neurons. So just like you have a wire, right? Like I have this wire here if you're on video, and it's coated, right, to protect it. The same thing happens in your brain. Your brain lays down a special coating called myelin. And it actually starts from the back of the brain. And then people probably know this. The last thing the myelin is your frontal lobe, right? That's why when we were teenagers, we did dumb things, because our front part of our brains weren't myelinated. So we're like, we could drive 100 miles per hour. It's fine. That's not. Don't do that. Okay. That's not medical advice. So what happens is, what's really interesting is, so as this myelination is happening, the brain is developing, and then you're going to see, as that myelination happens, challenges potentially that show up when there are parts of the brain that are wired differently than neurotypicals. Now, in some ways, right, in some individuals with autism, this can actually be like a superpower, right? So they have, for example, when the auditory cortex starts myelinating, a heightened sense of audio that we as neurotypicals can't hear if you're a neurotypical listening. So many of my patients have told me, who have autism spectrum, will say, hey, you know, Dr. Jeremy, you know those fluorescent bulbs? I can hear them buzzing and it drives me nuts. I need different lighting in the school, because that lighting is I can't tune it out because I'm so sensitive to it. Alternatively, right, there's a great book, it's called The Pattern Seekers, and it's about how some individuals who have autism become so engrossed because they can see patterns that neurotypicals can't see, and they become so engrossed with the patterns. So you may see sometimes, for example, a child who seems extremely fascinated by things that spin or light up, and they're kind of like get really close to it and stare at it for long periods of time because they're sort of seeing a pattern that maybe we don't see or appreciate, or we kind of ignore. So they can get stuck in those patterns. But what you want to do is you want to be able to give them treatment that is autism specific, so that you can give them, you know, coping behaviors that are consistent with that. Well, why is that? You know, can we help them not hear the light bulbs, right? So that it's not so annoying, or tune it out, or, you know, if their language is a problem, right? They have a delayed language development, which is often one of the first signs that we see with autism. How do we support language development, right? Or help them with understanding social cues, which is another, you know, area of challenge sometimes if you have autism. And so, again, if you don't understand it and you don't understand it in context, you can start applying speech therapy, but realize like, oh, that's actually not effective, because it's not that the speech is off per se, right? The thing that may be driving the speech impairment is that they actually don't understand socialization or are not picking up social cues. And so if you can tease out and identify and understand in a more comprehensive, holistic way what's going on with the child, you can help them better, and you can help their families better.
That's fascinating. I had no idea, actually. What's the difference between, so say somebody who gets diagnosed, let's say at 18 months versus, you said it, typically 3 years. So let's say 18 months versus somebody who gets diagnosed at 5 years old. Like, what are, I don't want to say worst case scenario, but like, what are the things that come to your mind as to like why that has to happen earlier. Like, you know, if you diagnose earlier, what happens next that's going to, and what would be the outcome of that?
Yeah, so the reality is that what we see is the earlier the kids get diagnosed, the more likely that they actually lose, quote unquote, the diagnosis of autism. And people sometimes don't understand me when I'm talking about when I say this. So in order for any condition in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual 5, which is sort of the diagnostic criteria for diagnosing psychiatric conditions, there is a condition in there that says that this thing has to cause significant impairment in the way that you function. So if I have obsessive compulsive traits, but it makes me a really good doctor and I don't freak out and can't leave the house because I'm, you know, concerned that I didn't turn off the oven or close the door and have to keep going back, right? Like, then that's a dysfunction. So then it becomes a disorder, right? So having obsessive...
Only when it has a negative impact is a disorder.
Exactly. So
you can have OCD, you can have like really bad OCD, but if the OCD is like making you a high performer and good at your job...
You wouldn't call it OCD. You'd call it obsessive compulsive traits, not obsessive compulsive disorder.
Oh, because it's not a disorder.
Exactly. So the same way, right? You can have inattentiveness or you could have hyperactivity, but it doesn't actually interfere with your ability to function, your schoolwork's great, then again, it's not considered a disorder, right? So in the same way, when these kids are diagnosed early, they get so much better. They don't have the challenges that are significantly impairing their ability to function, and then they are no longer considered autism disorder. This is this neurodivergent movement. Now, one of the things that we have to be really careful of is that is not the experience of many children with autism, though, still, right? There are kids which are, I don't like the terminology, and there's a lot of debate and very passionate people about how you should call certain things. So, by the way, I apologize if I've offended anyone listening if I didn't use the terminology that resonates with you. So sometimes people want to be referred to as autistic individuals. Sometimes it's individuals with autism, which is person first, nomenclature. But again, the intention, and just know that in my heart of hearts, like, I'm just trying to do the right thing for everybody. And again, I apologize if I, you know, didn't say it in the way that resonates with you. But I think the profound autism, right, is how it's termed, are individuals who tend to have complete nonverbal. They can't communicate in a neurotypical way. And they may have very severe, even self-harming behaviors like headbanging or hitting themselves. And for individuals with profound autism, again, you have to understand, like, what is going on? What is triggering that behavior that is so disruptive and or so challenging? And I think in this specific instance, I think this is another thing that I just can't accept. I think a lot of people write those kids off or write those individuals off. In my experience, and again, it's an N of one, but it's decent because I've seen a lot of kids with neurodevelopmental disorders and profound autism, is that we actually have, they have a lot going on inside, but they're almost trapped inside their bodies. And it's kind of sad. So I'll give you an example. There was a kid who for a long time they are nonverbal. And I fought really, really hard to help this mom and dad get their child a what we call augmentative communication device. So the child now has a platform in which they can push buttons and create sentences based on graphical images. And this kid has, although nonverbal, has very profound statements that they can generate independently without the parent with their tablet. And every time I come in, they're like, "Dr. Tarman, good to see you." You know, and they would tell me like just amazing things on their tablet. But this was a kid that had been written off as, oh, they are nonverbal and intellectually disabled. But it was just because they didn't have the right tool to help them communicate and engage in a neurotypical world. And we were able to help that child get that. So again, I think there's a lot there that's being missed. And I think that there's so much that we can do to help A, identify these kids earlier, try and make it so that their experience of autism is no longer a disorder. And then for the ones where they are really having this profound manifestation of autism that is affecting their ability to function in the world, figure out ways that we can adapt the world so that they can have a better experience in that world that we live in.
And that makes a lot of sense, because essentially, I mean, it determines so much if you're able to diagnose earlier. If you're not able to diagnose earlier, I mean, I'm sure that it makes a lot of parents frustrated, and especially if they're, you know, having to go to school and everything, they're not given the right tools to be successful and to be the best versions of themselves, right?
And absolutely. I mean, even think about this. I like to pull examples from my own life. My daughter will hate me for this, but it's okay. Right. So one of my daughters was like lashing out and like acting up and like just being like really just like a just really nasty person. And I'm like, what is going on? And, you know, we as parents, right, you think you're doing the right thing. And I, you know, we got mad and we started disciplining. And then we realized, like, you know what? Actually, my kid's being bullied at school and getting picked on. And that's why they're lashing out. And so my reaction was the wrong reaction. I shouldn't be disciplining my child. I should be trying to figure out, well, why are they acting that way, which is very different. And I think as parents, what I've seen, unfortunately, is, you know, kids who have autism act differently. Sometimes their behavior seems, you know, like to be something of like a spoiled child, maybe, or like a child who doesn't behave, right? And I think we've probably all kind of seen this or experienced at a grocery store. We're like, oh, that kid's on the floor. What a bad parent, you know, because the kid's throwing a tantrum. But you don't know what the child's lived experience is. They may be having something that's very sensitive, you know, sensory, you know, problematic for them, right? And many of these kids have sensory issues where certain temperatures, touch, sound, lights are very agitating. And you don't experience that, but I probably could simulate it for you. Like, how many times have you smelled something where you're like, oh my gosh, that's horrible? Amplify that by 100 times and then put yourselves in that child's shoes. So as a parent, right, if I have a child with autism who's throwing a tantrum, it's not a discipline thing I need to do. I need to understand, well, maybe that's a sensory issue. How do I help that child from a sensory perspective? So I think these are all things that, as much as we want to have autism acceptance and accept people for their neurodivergence, which I think is beautiful, we also have to be very realistic. We live in a very dysfunctional system that's missing a lot of kids. It's missing kids that are the most vulnerable. So females, persons of color, low socioeconomic status. We've got mandates that are unacceptable. We've got clinicians that are unfortunately abdicating their responsibility. And we've got clinicians that are wearing waitlists as a badge of honor. And, you know, the problem is you're part of the problem, whether we want to admit it or not. And so for me, it was, I can't be part of the problem. I have to be part of the solution. So I'm encouraging, hopefully, anybody listening to the podcast, don't be afraid to pick up something innovative. Don't be afraid to challenge the status quo, because nothing's going to change if nothing changes.
No, I completely agree. And yeah, I mean, this is a big issue right now, I think, for a lot of specialties in America, is that there's just not enough doctors. There's not enough doctors to see the amount of patients that need to be seen. And, you know, if a wait list is, let's just say a month or two, you and I both know for a lot of specialties, it's longer than that.
A month, a year to get an autism evaluation in some places.
But let's just say it's 2 months.
They're closed, Omar. They won't even see you. Forget it. You can't even get in. Not a month. Call. They'll tell you, sorry, we're closed for 24. Call us in the new year, and we'll see you maybe next year.
But even, yeah, I was going to say, even that, we have to take into account that the average patient, it's going to be even delayed long, because, you know, patients, they work, they have busy schedules and everything. And I think for certain things, unless you're like it's something physically painful, right? It's something easy to remember, like, oh, we'll get to it. And then, like, that's how, like, years and years go by, you know? And then, you know, the problem gets worse and worse and worse, whatever it might be. As it relates to, let's say, Cogno, like, how does Cogno, is Cogno one of the things that can help solve that waitlist problem? Because it is an augmentation, right? You guys use AI, but how does Cogno essentially help solve that problem, though?
Yeah, so the product that we created called Canvas DX, again, it's FDA authorized, and the way that it works is when there's a developmental concern for children between 18 and 72 months, either by the parent caregiver or the doctor or clinician who sees the child, instead of having to do this, hey, go wait in a line somewhere and try and get an appointment with a developmental specialist or a pediatric neurologist or a psychologist, which is, again, if you go into just the psychology route, you're missing some of the maybe potentially medical things that are going on with the child too. And so that collaborative approach, I think, is really important. But nevertheless, so what happens is, instead of having to wait in the line in a primary care setting, they can have the parent upload the videos, answer some questions, the clinician answer some questions, and then instantaneously the algorithm, which was, again, trained up on hundreds of thousands of samples, can go back and say, okay, here's with a very high degree of confidence a positive or negative diagnosis for autism. We do neuroaffirming care, so we will actually pull out the strengths for the child and say, hey, this is where the child is actually doing really, really well. We'll characterize the challenges, and then we help automate the documentation, because I don't know if people know this, but there's this whole thing called like pajama time for doctors. And that's when we're sitting down after clinic, after we've had a long day and saw 30 patients, where you're sitting down and you're writing notes on all those 30 patients. Most doctors actually spend their nights, evenings, and weekends doing what we call charting, which is not a great use of their time. So being able to do that for them, I think, is a huge win. And then on the specialty side, most specialty physicians, they're taking hours to evaluate one child. And we think that we're doing the right thing. But if we're really being honest with ourselves, for that one child that's seeing me in the clinic that I took 3 hours or 4 hours to assess, if I could have seen four other kids, I've just harmed four children who are waiting in a wait list because I didn't see them and they're losing time that they could be getting treatment. And so again, if we're being really honest with ourselves as clinicians, you know, if you can get the same amount of information in a more efficient way, right, doing the old way is actually doing harm. And all of us took an oath to do no harm. So I can't accept people who are stuck in the status quo saying we're going to do these multi-hour assessments in person, you know, and then guess what? The kid who lives out in, you know, rural America or the desert or in a state where there are no developmental pediatricians, like, that's not fair. I give them a tool like Canvas DX that allows you to do a remote assessment and do it in a very efficient way without sacrificing accuracy. Why wouldn't you do anything differently?
No, I completely agree. Yeah. You know, for Autism Acceptance Month, what is your, you know, when you write these articles and you try and, you know, like raise awareness, of course, for it and everything, what are some of your hopes like with the general public, you know, in terms of the education and knowledge base?
Yeah, I think for a general public, right, we don't accept, right? I mean, if your child had a brain tumor and someone told you, I'm going to, you know, see you in a month, or at 2 months, or in this case, you know, 12 months, right? No one would accept that, right? And I think as a general population, although it may not be affecting you individually, your neighbor, one out of every four, or one in every six of your neighbors is trying to get their child a developmental evaluation, and they're stuck on a waitlist. And so I think we collectively need to advocate for better resources, adoption of technology, because look, the reality is there's only so many pediatric neurology and pediatric developmental medicine slots in the country. And, you know, I invest in mentorship and I do a lot of it. And I've, you know, invested decades to create, you know, two pediatric neurologists now, literally mentoring people for over 10 years to help make more pediatric neurologists. But that's a huge investment that I do individually. You know, is that really going to move the needle? And they're great pediatric neurologists that I've helped mentor and train and get them excited about pediatric neurology and kind of follow me in my footsteps. But the reality is like, again, maybe they see a couple thousand kids, right? We have to do something systematically. And so I think collectively as a society, we've got to invest in our children. And when a child has a developmental delay, if we really want to help them be as productive as they can be and have the best outcomes, we've got to demand that they get that early intervention. And there should be no barriers and no obstacles, and that everything should be an easy button. Because once it starts becoming hard, you're a single parent with a developmentally delayed child, it your whole world gets turned upside down, right? When are you going to take time off to go and actually see the specialist? You know, some of these specialists are asking these parents to fill out hours of paperwork just to get an appointment. How is that fair? Oh, and by the way, it's not available in Spanish, you know, or any other language. So we are committed. We did Spanish. We're working on other languages. And again, I think my hope is this is not about selling a product, you know, for me. This is about how do I help in an area where I saw so much inequity and so much injustice and so much bias? And how do I figure out a systematic way, very mission-driven, to help people as much as possible? You know, you know, people are sometimes get worked up about like business models and things like that. But the reality is that this has to be sustainable. There has to be some health economics around it. And I think we've demonstrated very, very compellingly that just in the time these kids are waiting for a diagnosis, the amount of healthcare expenditure that's happening is twice as much as the child that gets diagnosed early. Because what happens? These kids end up getting referred to, oh, go see the ophthalmologist. Maybe there's something wrong with their vision. Go see the ENT. Maybe there's something wrong with their hearing. Oh, maybe they're having seizures. Go get an EEG, right? And so there's all this stuff that's happening. And then, by the way, if you have a child who has autism, and unfortunately I've seen this, you know, where you don't recognize it and the child doesn't recognize danger, they go run out in the street and they get hit by a car and they end up in the ICU for 6 months. And they have neurologic trauma now on top of the autism, which, you know, I don't have great ways to reverse neurotrauma, right? Or, you know, I've seen cases where kids have really picky eating because they have sensory issues and nobody's addressing it. And they end up with a nutritional deficiency. And I, you know, I've said this before, you know, like I should never see a kid admitted for scurvy in this day and age because they had a nutritional deficiency because somebody missed it, that child had autism and they weren't addressing their, you know, nutritional needs. Like that's just unacceptable in this day and age. And again, nobody should have to wait for an appointment to start getting treatment and therapy directed to help their child achieve the best developmental outcomes as possible.
No, I couldn't have said it better myself, and I'm so happy. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on, because you sit in one of those really unique positions. Again, like you're in a very rare specialty, being a child neurologist, but also the CEO of a digital health company that's tackling this issue. And so, just hearing your perspective on this is like very like refreshing and fascinating to hear. You know, I want to like remind the listeners like to learn more, especially for one, Dr. Tarman's got a fantastic LinkedIn profile, so you can look him up on LinkedIn. But to go check out Cognoa at cognoa.com. That's cognoa.com. And Sharif, you know, as you kind of round out the interview, and again, welcome you back on the show, sort of last message and thoughts to the audience.
Yeah. So I think, of course, April, I'm accepting of autism. But I think everyone needs to stand up for changing, especially these archaic policies and, you know, ways of doing things. And, you know, as parents, we should demand better. And as a country, we should demand and expect better. And it's disappointing that we haven't figured this out yet. But I am hopeful and I am anticipating that, you know, there is a new standard of care for developmental delay that's being fostered by people who are innovative and passionate about this. And I think we as a society are becoming more inclusive and accepting of people who have neurodivergence.
That's fantastic. Sharif, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was just very inspiring to listen to you. To our audience, thanks again for listening. This has been another episode of The State of MedTech. Happy Autism Acceptance Month, and we'll see you all next time.
Thank you for enjoying another epic episode of The State of MedTech. If you're feeling inspired and love this episode, do us a favor, hit that subscribe button and turn notifications on so you never miss an episode. And be sure to give us 5 stars and write a short review, because that helps more people discover this amazing community of ours. If you're a company who has a executive that you'd like to be on the show, or perhaps you want to sponsor one of the episodes, shoot us an email at hello@katibandco.com. Take care. See you next time.